Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming this morning, and welcome to the United States Institute of Peace. The United States Institute of Peace is an independent, nonpartisan national institution which was established by Congress. Its mission is to prevent violence, to resolve international conflict, to promote post-conflict stability and democratic transformation. In the past decade, the Institute has brought parties together to international conflicts in the Balkans, the Middle East, South Asia, and other parts of the world. We have brought together people who were in conflict with one another. We have provided a safe space for them to have a reasoned dialogue about their differences. We're now broadening that effort to Latin America and the Caribbean. This is the second event hosted by USIP's new Haiti Working Group. The working group is modeled after highly successful working groups as the Institute has run for the past year on Iraq and Afghanistan. The Haiti Working Group at USIP is chaired by former Senator Malcolm Wallop, who has a long interest in Haiti. Senator Wallop is with us this morning, and we'll hear from him in a minute. My name is Bob Perito. I'm the executive director of the Haiti Working Group, and I'll be the moderator of the panel this morning. Over the coming year, the Haiti Working Group will host monthly meetings concerned with Haiti's future. Our goal is to provide a forum for open and frank discussion of the challenges facing Haiti today and the U.S. relationship with Haiti. I want to thank you all for coming this morning, and I'm looking forward to a very informative session. This morning, we're going to look at the public security crisis that confronts Haiti. In addition to our chairman, Malcolm Wallop, we have a distinguished panel of experts to discuss this subject. And it's a great pleasure for me this morning because I can truly say that this is a panel of people who are really old friends of mine and people that I've known over the years. Our first speaker this morning will be Ambassador Tim Carney. Tim has just been named the new interim coordinator for the State Department's Office of Reconstruction and Stability. But more importantly, for our purposes here this morning, he has just recently returned from a stint as the chargé at the United States Embassy in Port-au-Prince. And previous to that, he was the United States Ambassador in Haiti and in the Sudan. Our second speaker this morning will be Commissioner Mark Croker. Commissioner Croker is the senior police officer in the United Nations system. His formal title is Senior Police Advisor to the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. But Mark heads the United Nations police force, which today is what, 8, 9?
About 7,000.
7,000 strong. I first met Mark when he came to the Department of Justice with a team of police specialists from around the United States and helped write the basic plan for what became the Haitian National Police. Then I met Mark in Bosnia, where he was serving as Deputy Commissioner for the International Police Task Force, and most recently in Liberia, when the city of Monrovia exploded in riots, and Mark led his forces in to quell that disturbance. Our final speaker this morning, Carl Alexander, and Carl, another old friend of mine. Carl is the director of the Office of Prosecutorial Development and Training at the U.S. Department of Justice. Carl went into Haiti in 94 and began the U.S. Judicial Assistance Program to Haiti and has followed Haiti closely ever since. So this morning, I'd like to begin by inviting our chairman, Senator Wallop, to say a few words, and then I'll invite each of the speakers in order to come to the podium and make their presentations.
Good morning to you all, and welcome. And thank you for your interest and presence here. It was just a year ago that a number of us were in Haiti in connection with the Task Force on Reform in the UN. We were, I think fair to say, uniformly struck then by the critical importance of security issues. Without some basic security, progress in other needed areas is virtually impossible. It is not possible for the various functions of government to operate responsibly and credibly without basic security. And despite the presence of the UN peacekeeping force, Haiti's security system remains very precarious. Armed gangs Remnants of the old army and the drug lords continue to operate with impunity. Haiti's beleaguered police often seem to be more a part of the problem than its solution. The country's judicial system barely functions, and the state of prisons are far below international standards. The campaign leading up to the April 23rd elections, parliamentary elections, promises to provide the impetus for even more violence. This will place additional pressure on the Haitian police and the UN mission, which are already stretched extremely thin. As President Préval prepares to assume office, he faces a long list of challenges. Restoring security, enabling Haitians to go about their daily lives without fear, has to be among his top priorities. The question is, how will this be possible, and in what ways can he be assisted in making it possible? This morning we have a distinguished group of experts, as Bob has mentioned, to discuss the issue of creating a safe and secure environment in Haiti. We're grateful to have them with us, and I'm looking forward to hearing their remarks. I'm looking forward to the functioning of this committee on Haiti and see if there isn't some possible way that we can assist the beleaguered nation in coming to its rightful place in this hemisphere. So thank you and welcome to all the panel.
Thank you. Mr. Bester?
Thank you very much, Senator. Thank you, Bob, for the introduction. Good morning, everyone. It feels far too chilly to be the 24th day of March, especially if you've just come up from Port-au-Prince, where the best months of the year are January and February. I'm going to talk a little bit about what concerns everybody in Haiti, security, and I'll define it fairly narrowly for our purposes this morning. But I thought I'd give you first a little flavor for what's going on. Yesterday, radio, or maybe the day before, Radio Cap Haïtien, 96.1 on your FM dial, but only if you're in Cap Haïtien, announced that the traffic police had stated that they were in the process of seizing motorcycles that did not have license plates on them. And that was done, quote, to reduce crime because the gutter snipes, that's my translation of the French word voyou, who perpetrate the majority of banditry, run around on unlicensed motorcycles. But more to the purpose of our meeting today, the story added, police made it known that serious problems tied to lack of materiel forestall the police from being effective. And meanwhile, in Port-au-Prince, the Director General of the Haitian National Police, Mario Andrasol, has let it be known that kidnapping is on the decline in the metropolitan area. Quote, only a few were noted last week in Port-au-Prince, he told the press. But, he added, nighttime robberies are on the rise, using the Creole word zenglendo. He also noted that police confront a crucial problem of equipment. And we'll be hearing a lot about that. I don't plan to steal the thunder of the commissioner or of Carl Alexander when it comes to equipment and what we all can help do there. So what I'm focusing on here, in other words, is security heavily centering on life, property, and maybe organized crime. Let me add that border security, not only with the DR, the Dominican Republic, but with Haiti's waters, are also elements of the security equation. Let's see, it would have been 17 days ago, the Special Representative of the Secretary General, Juan Gabriel Valdez, was on Radio Metropole. He was in front of the microphones facing one of the most gifted journalists in Haiti, Rochille Francois, who was interrogating him about the recently signed Memorandum of Understanding on the professionalization of the police. This created a minor firestorm in Haiti in a way that I'm going to again, shuffle a responsibility on the commissioner to talk about. And he made a couple of interesting points. The first, he argued that to provide security, the important instrument is the Haitian National Police. And that is, in fact, true, and we'll go into that in a little more detail in a few minutes. What are the issues we're looking at? And I hope to discuss, at least touch on very briefly here. First of all, threats. Second, instruments. And third, professionalization, assistance, sort of international attention rubric. And when I look at threats, first of all, there are the rural areas of Haiti, which are generally fairly calm. Now, about a, well, it must have been a year ago, there was a worry in Haiti that the former military, including elements that had come across the border as part of the effort that dislodged the former president, that some of those former military were active in the communal sections, appointing individuals to effectively be law and order out in those communal sections. Could never track that down in the 6 months that I was there. There apparently wasn't much to that fear. At least in the elections, there didn't seem to be any activity that would suggest that that rumor had any currency or had any reality to it. There were, of course, as we all know, some incidents in rural areas during the electoral period, and especially as election day approached, with maybe half a dozen at the most voting centers either destroyed or burned or otherwise rendered inoperative. Urban areas tend to be the focus of everyone's attention, and that's for a couple of commonsensical reasons. One is there's a greater concentration of people in those areas. More people are affected, especially when you look at the metropole, that is Port-au-Prince. And second, it's the CNN effect. There's a lot of international and, indeed, a huge amount of Haitian press in Port-au-Prince especially, and there is a much broader and deeper press focus on what's going on there. What do we have in these urban areas? We have crimes committed for gain. And those criminals believe they benefit from chaos, and they are active in fomenting, tolerating that kind of chaos. You have, for example, gang control of a number of upcountry ports, and that has relevance to the issue of threats to borders. Because you see smuggling of arms into Haiti through these ports. You also see smuggling of narcotics possible through these ports. And, of course, you have the massive evasion of customs duties that has implications for the running of Haiti through the collection of revenue. I'm not sure what percent of cars that fail the Florida state inspection are shipped down to Haiti through those ports, but I have a hunch that it's pretty large. You've got, in addition to the ports, you've got certain areas of Haiti that are not under the control of the government, so-called areas of non-law, rough translation from the French, and the one that makes everybody's headlines is Cité Soleil, a very large agglomeration where roughly 55,000 people registered to vote in the first round for the current elections, first round of which was the 7th of February. You have the narcotics traffickers. I've mentioned the possibility of using the ports that are not under the control of the authorities. You have a large number of aircraft flights and go-fast, what we used to call cigarette boats, when I was a lot younger, coming up from Venezuela now, as well as Colombia, to bring 800 or so kilos of cocaine to Haiti, mainly to be transshipped. The only good thing I can say about narcotics is nearly as I could determine was that in the 7 years since I had been ambassador in Haiti, there did not seem to be a great increase in Haitian addiction to cocaine. That may just simply be because everybody's too poor to be able to afford it, no matter that the traffickers usually want to pay in product because it's a lot cheaper than paying in cash. What other kind of threats do we have in urban areas? We have politically related crimes, and that's a pretty large rubric that we might talk about more in discussion than that I'm going to touch on here. We're looking, for example, at intimidation. There was a belief, and indeed it was broadly public, that the December wave of kidnappings was focused on the middle class and upper class areas of Haiti in order to intimidate people from going out to vote. Well, this analysis, I think, was a little too clever by half because nobody was intimidated against voting on the 7th of February. I mean, anybody who was out there and watched all those people persevering through the ragged organization of that election, of the hours spent waiting in line. And I mean, I saw people from the head of Barbancourt Distillery. You all will know that when you leave Haiti, there is a characteristic American Airlines boarding card. It's a yellow plastic box with five bottles of Barbancourt from duty-free. All these people were in line waiting with other people. Nobody was in a coat and tie, let me add. What about this gang phenomenon? What are we talking about here? It's clear there's a mix of the criminal and the political. Originally, the gangs, by originally I mean since 1995 or so, gangs were fomented largely by the former president and his associates, partly, if I can be analytical, as a means of balancing against the Haitian National Police. The former president was always sensitive to the possibility of rivals, and he never wanted any individual or any institution to be so competent as to present themselves as a rival to him, to his own self. Some of these gangs grew out of the uproar following the departure on the 29th of February 2 years ago. But the key issue is what to do with the gangs and how to do it. And this is a problem because of the large amount of arms that are in Haiti. It's a problem because the classic UN or Coalition of the Willing or the classic DDR approach to armed entities, the sort of disarmament, demobilization, and rehabilitation, doesn't seem to apply to criminal gangs as opposed to armed units. I might add it failed in Iraq, but that was for different reasons. Iraq would have been an exceptionally good test case for a DDR effort. But if you've got criminal gangs as opposed to armed entities, the ex-FOD were the initial target of the DDR effort, but they seem to dissolve. The UN, the Stabilization Mission, known under the French acronym MINUSTAH, is at a serious guess on what exactly to do, what the best way is to approach these criminal gangs. Now, there have been a number of people who have argued that basically, especially when it concerns Cité Soleil, you just go in and smash them. And that has been rejected. The Brazilians showed the way in two of the suburbs of Port-au-Prince by moving in gently, step by step. Yes, there were people shot, There were innocent people shot and killed as part of those efforts, but it was generally, it was a very late effort. It was more than a year, I think, after the UN mission was established. But Bel Air and, to a lesser extent, Cité Militaire are both of them more or less under back under the control of the government, the interim government at this point. Cité Soleil seems to be much more difficult, much different, and there continues to be a discussion, an argument, let's say, within MINUSTAH circles and among core group ambassadors, the group that is essentially an advisory body to both the Secretary General in New York and to the Special Representative in Port-au-Prince, on how exactly, rather on the extent to which the gangs are political and the extent to which they are purely criminal. The argument now is that there is a far greater political element, because if you look at the results of Election Day and at the results of protest, which were by and large peaceful, although you might argue 3,000 people in the pool at the Hotel Montana was not quite as peaceful and had a lot of potential for violence, but it was essentially more peaceful than it was violent by far. Somebody seems to have a political element of influence, if not control, that might be worked with and through to end the existence of gangs as an important element of control in a place like Cité Soleil. Well, we'll see about that. Now, I spoke just now about threats. Let me look a little bit at instruments. And I'm not going to go into great detail here, as we have a responsible cadre from the department concerned, but it is clear that the UN Stabilization Mission is the largest, most coherent force for law and order in Haiti, and it has the mandate to be effective. It's a Chapter 7 mission. It has the mandate for stabilization. That mandate was strengthened in about June or July of last year when it acquired the authority to actually vet candidates for the next instrument I'm going to discuss. The UN's got about 7,400 troops under a Brazilian force commander. The deputy force commander is a Chilean. There is a UN police element of 1,775 there under a Mountie, a Canadian. You've got police divided in two sort of elements. One are foreign police units, combat police with armor, with body armor and armored vehicles. The Chinese are there. They were the ones who were protecting the large voting center that is just on the outskirts of Cité Soleil, and that is also the locus for the place where the tabulation center, where the votes were actually counted. The Pakistanis up in Gonaïf have a foreign police unit. And then there are UN police elements from a number of countries, including, say, France and the U.S. And Canada itself. The other entity, the one that we all want to take over, is the Haitian National Police itself. And the Haitian National Police has what, say, 5,000, I'll just throw that figure out. About 1,000 have been recruited over the last year. There are some problems. The first is politicization. That is something that the former president began a campaign to effect when I was ambassador there in 1999. The signal 1999 development was when he forced to flee into exile the Secretary of State for Public Security, Bob Manuel, who is President-elect Preval's closest advisor today. Preval, as president, argued to Manuel that he could not protect Manuel unless he stayed in the presidential palace 24 hours a day, and thus counseled his friend and advisor to flee back in 99. That politicization ultimately resulted, when the former president fled, in the police collapsing. It either collapsed into criminal activity, and that's an important dimension of the threat that I failed to touch on, or they just ran for it. Now, the most recent development on that is a promise that President-elect Preval made to Representatives Waters and Foley when they visited Port-au-Prince last week, that he was committed to a non-politicized police force and would work to ensure that would happen. Other problems with the police are corruption. And unfortunately, Haiti is among the most corrupt countries that exist in the hemisphere. It's a national problem, something recognized repeatedly by the Director General. He has begun efforts to clean up the police. They're fraught. He himself is a target for death. He has broad support in the elite and throughout society for making a functioning police force. Police have also been engaged in human rights abuses. This is an aspect of serious concern throughout the world, certainly here in Washington, and indeed in Port-au-Prince. I've spoken a bit about a UN role through the Memorandum of Understanding. There's a bilateral aspect to professionalizing the Haitian National Police. There are, at this point, really two countries seriously involved in the bilateral efforts. It's Canada and the U.S. We got about $15 million for fiscal year 06 in that effort, and a total of $25 million for the two previous fiscal years. We're not just looking, of course, at the police. We need a security structure, a justice structure that is much broader in Haiti. The police can only do so much without a judiciary that is responsive to the national requirements. The judiciary, again, has problems of corruption, but at a certain risk, I would argue we have some mechanical and logistics problems with the judiciary that need to be addressed on an urgent basis. An examining magistrate, a juge d'instruction, has no vehicle, usually an inadequate office space, not much in the way of files, and only one clerk. Now, this is clearly not possible, and I know Bob Perito has a background in this and can probably speak more intelligently than I can. And the prisons. And part of the nexus between the judiciary and the prisons is you have a huge number of prisoners awaiting the next step. I'm going to be as vague as that in the process, because the French Code Napoleon exists in Haiti, and the process is not the same as it is in the United States. Just why you have to be careful when someone asks you to sign up on something which condemns the Haitian government for not charging someone. That isn't quite the way the judicial system works there. In any case, there are a lot of people in jail for longer than they would have served if they had been brought to trial and found guilty of the crime that they're being examined for. It's a reality. We can talk about other aspects of and individuals in a Q&A period. Let me stop there. I think that's probably longer than I should have talked.
Thank you very much for that overview, Tim. Commissioner?
Good morning, everyone. And thank you, Bob, for that introduction. It's a pleasure and honor for me to be here at the United States Institute of Peace with colleagues and friends and those who have been working around the world to pursue that distant goal of peace in our time. Hard to do. And my responsibility as a police officer, of course a peace officer in this endeavor, is to look at the slice of all of this that has to do with the police. And I'll take you back about 10 years with me at a hotel here, the Marriott Hotel, close to this location. And this small team that Bob mentioned and I were gathered, and we'd been assembled from various police organizations in the U.S., me from Los Angeles, and a few guys from Arizona State Police and Phoenix and so forth, and we were discussing what was happening. A man burst into our office with a situation report. I had a flip chart on. We were working on this plan as to how to go about this reform process for the Haitian police, and he told us a story about how in Port-au-Prince, a person who had been disgruntled because of a slow response by the fire brigade that was part of the FOD. The FOD was the military, and it was in the FOD that the police service operated at the time, the Force Armée d'Haïti. And so he had responded to a police facility and said, a FOD facility, and said, you know, I'm really upset. My house burned down, and you didn't respond, and I've lost everything. And they responded to this complaint by shooting him and killing him and putting his body in front of the police station as a sign to others that might have some, disgruntled feelings. This, to me, became a symbol. And we were talking about an organization that would be service-oriented with, an outreach to the community with community policing and so forth. And so I wrote on the flip chart, first rule of community policing in Haiti, don't shoot the customer. And it's a little bit grim. It's police humor, if you will. But the fact is, if we can get past the point of mistreating those who come to us for help, at least that's progress. Has that progress been made from that point in 1994 until now, 12 years later? It remains to be seen, and we hear the accounts that come to us, like Ambassador Carney's, of the situation in Haiti that would not give us all that much hope. But yet I remain optimistic as a police officer, and certainly in my responsibility overseeing police components in our UN missions around the world, I do remain optimistic about Haiti. And I would begin with my few remarks, going back to some fundamental principles that I think should guide discussions when it comes to police in these post-conflict situations. Our responsibility, of course, as UN police around the world, by way of strategic mission, is to build institutional police capacity in these post-conflict environments. That is our job with the United Nations. Now, we've taken that on as a primary focus. So we no longer monitor the police purely. We reform, restructure, rebuild the police. And yes, on some occasions we take the place of the police and substitute authority executive missions. Or, as you heard, in a Chapter 7 mission, we support the peace and stability with a mandate that is not substitution authority, but it gives us enough authority to maintain or to move toward a safe and secure environment. But the principles are very clear. I remember a speech that Bill Marriott, the founder of the Marriott chain, made one time. And at the end of the speech, the person who introduced him said, Mr. Marriott, if you could give a single message to all the guests of all the Marriott hotels around the world, what would you say? And he said, the shower curtain goes on the inside of the tub. He brought it down to the basics. And so just quickly as we begin, if I might, I would like to mention a few shower curtain initiatives when it comes to police in post-conflict environments around the world that I believe in and that I'm carrying forward in my position of leadership with the United Nations as a police advisor in the Department of Peacekeeping. The first initiative is that pure monitoring, wastes money. Just to observe things and not have any action to fix things is a waste of time. The public notion of international police officers as monitors, it has to go. It's a waste of everyone's money, including all the those who contribute to the United Nations. Next initiative is that it takes time and patience. I've had many an argument with sometimes military people who said, we need to stand up the police because we need an exit strategy. And I've said, those two things should not be said in the same sentence. You need to grow a police. It's generational. It's patience that is required. And you should not necessarily link it to an exit strategy. It was Costa Rica's president who once said, peace has an unfinished line. There's how do they put it? Peace has no finishing line. I think that's a good statement by former President Arias. And so it must go with police. There's no finishing line in police reform, and you can't build it to a certain point. Yes, critical mass has to be established, but when we use simplistic numbers of how we have trained this many or done that much, then we can run into trouble, I think, because it takes, in many cases, a generation. We have to be patient with it. Next initiative is that military and police and politics do not mix. We have to separate the police from the military, and we have to separate the politics from the police. What am I saying here? That the police are not accountable to the political establishment? No, they need to be accountable to the public and to the governments that enable them, and certainly most of all to the law that authorizes them, as we respond in rule of law. Next initiative, it is never the wrong time to do the right thing. The right thing is community policing in any environment. No matter what the situation, no matter what the warfare, the mud, the dust, or the blood, it is the right thing to do, to engage the police, to engage the community, and establish a bond, problem-solving, community orientation. All those things can and should be done right from the start. Next is that values are priceless, and when we live in a society where there's a price on everything and a value on almost nothing in many cases, and so I have found that as we build police organizations, the first place we start with a series of values. Next is police need partners, and I think we're going to hear a little bit about the judiciary and correctional reform and all those things that go into making a society that has a respect for the rule of law. As over all of us, the data is the antidote of anecdotalism. Anecdotalism being that disease that drives a lot of discussion in these environments. And when we have data, when we have empirical information, that should in every case trump the latest story that is told, because it gives us a bigger picture. It gives us a more accurate one of the way things really are. And finally, reforming without rebuilding is like architecture without construction. We can say all day long, you know, that we are reforming the police and we are rehabilitating them and so forth. But unless we provide the materials that are necessary and tools that are necessary for them, it is an empty reform process. And that requires donors. You heard Ambassador talking about the contribution the U.S. is making, the Canadians are making. These contributions have to be coordinated. They are. This discussion goes on among the ambassadors and the people in the field. They must be conditionalized. That is to say that in any situation when there is a gift that is to be made, there should be a response on the side that says that this is in keeping with your commitment to reform, to build capacity in your organization with all the principles of human rights that we all talk about. And so those are the principles that I hold to as we get engaged so many times in complex discussions about the way things are. Now, to get to Haiti a little bit, and I would not repeat, and I've extracted from my remarks some of the things that Ambassador Carney has said, but it's right down the road, and it's a very good description that he has given of the situation. It is a grim situation in Haiti. There is no question about it. It is not a pretty picture. And the many trips that I have made there, the recent trips that I have made, give a flavor of a garrisoned community, people in fear, people living especially in the principal city, Port-au-Prince, in a state of siege. And this is unacceptable, especially Cité Soleil. So in a sense, and if you'd allow it a description, there are two Haitis. There's Haiti, and then there's Port-au-Prince. And a third one is Cité Soleil. So there are your three Haitis. One Haiti is fairly good. Fairly peaceful. Another Haiti is a little bit overly populated, highly overly populated, and it is a dangerous city. But the true threat and the true danger right now, and where these gangs that Ambassador talked about, these armed street gangs, slashed, sometimes viewed as militias, but really street gangs and maybe politically driven and all those things that are said, that emanates out of that one very malignant area called Cité Soleil. It's true. It's a grim situation. Now, I have recent data, however, that things may be getting a little bit better. Mario Andrusov gave that, the Director General of the National Police gave that that reassurance to the public recently. But in a greater sense, and reverting now to empiricism, as we looked at the kidnappings alone in the month of December in Haiti, there were some 100 or so, more than 100, with numerous victims. And then January, things were, in the early part, things were equally bad. February, a little bit difficult. But now in the first 15 days of March, there have been 6 kidnappings in Haiti, Port-au-Prince. Now, when you compare those 6 in the first 2 weeks of March with those 100 or so in the month of December, you can see that there is a reduction in kidnappings. Do I mean to say things are getting better in Haiti and we should all relax? No. But I'm just saying that when it comes to kidnappings, those have been reduced. A variety of reasons. We can get into that if you're interested in questions and answers. But the situation at large having to do with crime is unacceptable to the average person. And when we think of what it's like to live in a community where you are in constant fear, and if you have any money, those funds can be taken from you. If you have anybody prized in your family, that person can be taken from you. And with ransoms paid down to $100 to $500 for some of these kidnappings, we imagine, you know, ransoms of $100,000. I heard one negotiated settlement where they started $150,000, end up with $500 for a settlement for a kidnapping. But it's unacceptable to live in this state of siege, and we in the international community, those of our partners who are working there, share in this load. It is a difficult assignment to be involved in that particular mission, as I'm sure those who have served there can attest. Now, the security services. You've heard the depiction of the Haitian National Police. May I give you just a one-minute history of the Haitian National Police? It began as the Force Armée d'Haïti, military forces of Haiti. Then it became, in this transformation, with President Aristide returning and Operation Restore Democracy, the new police law that the U.S. Justice Department worked heavily on with the Haitian people to get that through, to empower the new Haitian National Police. It became the Haitian National Police. And for 5 short minutes in history, it was the Haitian National Police. And then over a short period of time, it became the Haitian Political Police. It was politicized. It was owned. It was taken hostage by the political elements of that country. So it belonged to the politicians. So from military to national police to political police, the future, there's no way in the future but to return it to the people. The Haitian National Police belongs to the people of Haiti. That's where it belongs. And its leadership should be in a team that is a meritocracy, whose people get positions based on their skill, their ability to pass certain tests and describe their competence and skills and abilities to those who would review their promotions, and not political injectees at all levels who smirk at the others who've been there in a long career because they just don't happen to know the right people. This is not a good police organization. You heard talk about corruption in Haiti and corruption in the organization. I would describe the Haitian National Police with 4 words: dysfunctional, disorganized, demoralized, and dishonest. Otherwise, it's a pretty good police organization. Dysfunctional, disorganized, demoralized, and dishonest. So there's a lot of work to do. One depiction, I'll just read it, coming out of one of the texts, says this: preliminary and estimated data accounted for about 6,300 police officers from all ranks in 2003, when in reality, today there are barely 4,000 officers at the present time. Most of its infrastructures were vandalized or destroyed during the crisis. In June 2004, an estimated 125 commissariats needed to be rehabilitated, 75 needed to be built or rebuilt, 90% of its radio communication means were destroyed or pillaged, and the network only operated in the metropolitan area. The number of motor vehicles was reduced to the bare minimum from 300 vehicles, and department directorates in November 2003, only half were left. And today, I don't think you'd see many police vehicles on the street at all. They're either not functioning, or they got stolen, or they got sold, or whatever. It's just dysfunctional. It has no or very little office supplies. So, you know, you can see a police organization that is in sad state of affairs. There's general consensus and public confidence in the HNP has been shaken by these allegations of criminal behavior. It's become very clear that some of the kidnappings themselves have been perpetrated by the police. The corruption level is enormous, and the challenges for the future are sometimes overwhelming. Yet we must continue, because the alternative is unacceptable. Chaos and a lack of security and people living in fear. That is the alternative, and it's not acceptable. And our commissioner will be working there. There's a draft reform plan for the police that is on the table right now in discussion with the new president and with his senior staff. It will be presented as things move along through a flow as his administration takes its roots. The Security Council will review that, and the special representative of the Secretary General at the UN will have his discussions and dialogue over the final elements of that plan, and the memorandum that exists between the United Nations and the government by way of certifying, decertifying, training, background check, vetting of the police, and giving them a form of rigor and a certain meritocracy. That is all in the making. But it requires constant vigilance, it requires a lot of help, and it requires committed people who really care. So I have to say in conclusion that I'm very pleased to be here with all of you. I assume by your presence that you do care about this very sad country. It needs a lot of help. And those of you who have been there and those of you who have seen the people know that, in fact, the very heart of the people is a good people. The Haitian people are wonderful, warm, loving, family people, and they deserve a good police that will protect them and help them instead of hurt them and harm them. That's what we're committed to doing for the future. And so we join in the discussion today with gratitude for the invitation, and hope that the dialogue, in fact, will produce some action, not just dialogue, as we constantly look for donors. If any one of you has a MasterCard or a Visa or something, we'll buy some equipment for the Haitian National Police, and we'll put it on your card. I always say, you know, donors are not just countries. They could be some of our wealthy citizens of the world, for example, who have some funds that they want to put in a humanitarian way. And may I say, as a police officer, what more humanitarian thing can you do for an average person than give them a good police officer who will come to their help rather than hurt them? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Carl?
Thank you very much, Bob, and thank you for the introduction. As Bob told you, I am an attorney. I work for the Justice Department, and all my life I've worked as a prosecutor. But what Bob didn't tell you, that I'm also a Haitian American, and for the past 12 years, I have been working on rule of law and administration of justice issues, first in Haiti and now in basically all regions of the world. And I do that on behalf of the Justice Department and the U.S. government. For those of you who don't know, and in the interest of full disclosure, there are really two offices at the Justice Department that provides technical assistance to emerging democracies in the criminal justice area. My office, OPDAT, and ECTAP, the group that Bob and talked about. Our goal is to strengthen the capacity of these law enforcement, of these countries to deal with their domestic crime problems so that they can become more effective and be better partners to other countries in the region where they are located, and also better partners internationally. My presentation today is going to focus basically in three general areas. One is, what have we done in the past in the rule of law and administration justice and administration of justice area? What difference has it made, and where do we go from here? And with respect to the latter part, I want to share with you a conversation, several conversations that I've had with the current Minister of Justice, because I thought it was important that I reach out to him, somebody I know, to get some insights on what the thoughts are in Haiti. About 10 years ago, I was assigned to work on rule of law and administration of justice programs in Haiti. That program actually was funded by USAID. The other programs that we have around the world, they are funded by the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, INL, at the State Department. When I got to Haiti in 1994 and early 1995, my team and I spent a great deal of time poring over the criminal procedure code in order to understand the intricacies of the Haitian criminal justice system. We organized short and long-term training programs for Haitian judicial officials. But as important, we spent quite a huge amount of time traveling around the country and saw for ourselves the conditions under which justice was administered. 9 years ago, I remember standing in front of colleagues at the Justice Department who work in this area, that is the criminal justice development area, and recall telling him that the justice system in Haiti was, and it's going to be a current refrain here, was dysfunctional. Regrettably, as you've heard already, it still is. The criminal procedure code is antiquated. Again, regrettably, it still is. Judges and prosecutors are not well trained. In fact, other than the law school training that they received back then, really they didn't receive any other training before they were appointed judges or prosecutors. There is, and there was at the time, no in-service training program, no continuing legal education, if you will. They were not well paid either. Most of them had to have another job in order to survive. They still do. Trials were conducted in dilapidated buildings. There was no court management, no case tracking to speak of. The courts and the prosecutor's offices lacked the resources and equipment that they needed to do their jobs. Again, it's a common refrain, no files, no folders, no cabinets, no pens, no pencil, and the list went on. In the investigation of criminal matters, there are serious systemic problems in the relationship between the police, the prosecutors, and the investigating magistrates. These deficiencies still exist. The task, I told my colleagues from Justice, was daunting, but with limited resources, and I'll get back to the issue of resources later in my presentation, the United States government, through USAID, the Department of Justice, and others, we worked very hard to remedy many of the problems that we saw. To address the training needs of the judiciary, we developed an emergency training program to, quote-unquote, jumpstart the justice system. We hired Haitian jurists, lawyers, to train other Haitian jurists. The Haitian Constitution provided for a École de la Magistrature, but it was just words on paper. USAID used its resources, and with the help of the Justice Department, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Ministry of Justice, and other international donors, we created a magistrate school. We organized a bunch of programs at that facility, both long-term and short-term programs. We coordinated our activities with the French and their École Nationale de la Magistrature. We collaborated with the Canadians and their Department of Justice. We worked with MECV, the United Nations Civilian Mission, in Haiti to develop what I believe back then was a very good program to develop the capacity of the judiciary. To address the resource needs of the judiciary, we developed, again with USAID funding, model jurisdictions. We equipped many of these jurisdictions with the basics that they needed to operate. And to address law reform, the United States government and others supported the work of a reform commission. While we were busy with the judges and the prosecutors, the Haitian National Police, as you've heard, was being trained and equipped on a parallel track. Thousands of police officers needed to be trained and be put to work to maintain law and order. This new police force and its institutions needed to be developed from scratch, basically. Needless to say, significantly more resources were devoted to the police development effort than the justice reform effort. It is no secret that we spent somewhere around like $60 million on the police and I think about $15 million on the rest of the justice sector. As the senior Department of Justice attorney on the ground back then, I went to countless interagency meetings in Haiti and in Washington where security and maintaining law and order was, for lack of a better term, an obsession with our policymakers. It was the only thing that people wanted to talk about. When they spoke of security, though, they were only focused on the police. They didn't think that once the police made an arrest, or at least if they thought about it, it was a passing thought, that you needed to do something with the people. And with respect to the prison, nobody wanted to deal with prisons back then. And still today, in our other initiatives around the world, it's still a huge struggle to get people to focus on prison reform. As I hope we have learned by now, serious reform of a country's criminal justice system is not cheap, and it requires the proportional allocation of resources among the three pillars of justice, that is the police, the judiciary, and the correction system. The notion of let's stand up the police now and we'll worry about the rest later is not a responsible approach. Of course, I'm exaggerating here because nobody actually said that. But if you were me working in Haiti between 1995 and mid-1997, and my team was there for much longer, that's really the way you felt, that the focus was on getting boots on the ground, police on patrol, and that's all that mattered. Regrettably, because of a lot of circumstances, a lot of things that were going on the ground, the intensity of our assistance in Haiti started to diminish starting around 2000, 2001. While AID continued with targeted programs working with civil society, U.S. DOJ closed its program down in July 2000. There are several factors, as I mentioned, lack of political will on the part of the government of Haiti, the fact that Haiti had essentially become a narco-trafficking state was another factor. Not certain that we had reliable partners to work with. All these things were contributing factors. Now we roll forward to 2006. A few days ago, I read with great interest the recently released report of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and it's entitled Haiti, Failed Justice or the Rule of Law, Challenges Ahead for Haiti and the International Community. I think it was just released just a few weeks ago, right? Maybe even this week. Let me just read you a few passages, and you'll see why I spent some time talking to you about all these things that we did. The commission said the following. For over 40 years, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has monitored the situation of human rights in the Republic of Haiti. For much of this period, the people of Haiti have faced many hardships, including political instability and violence, serious human rights abuses with no accountability, and exploitation and degradation of the country's economy and infrastructure. And here's the rub. Unfortunately, Haiti's recent history has not revealed much progress in reversing this course. Indeed, not much progress has been made, particularly in the justice sector, and I'm not very proud to report on that. The commission continued with the following observations and findings, and I quote, "The working conditions for magistrates at all levels are substandard, with shortages of space and basic resources, lack of proper training for judges, and inadequate security for judges in court facilities. Further, the independence of the judiciary continues to be imperiled through potential inadequacies in security of tenure, allegations of interference by the executive branch in the assignment of specific cases before the court, and the absence of a proper and functioning oversight mechanism for the judiciary, among other factors. These and other inadequacies in Haiti's court system, including the outdated nature of many of Haiti's laws, lack of effective access to legal assistance, and the failure of the police to execute judicial orders have created chronic and unacceptable delays in the processing of cases in the court system. An estimated 85% to 90% of detainees have not been tried. That's scandalous. Utterly scandalous. Yesterday, I read these passages as I was putting the final touches on my presentation. I read these passages to a friend who is familiar with the Haiti system, with the Haitian system, and he responded, "Well, what do you expect? It's deja vu all over again." Well, I got to tell you, folks, if we, the international community, if we're not smarter, if we do not invest more wisely, if we're not, and this is something that Mr. Croker mentioned, if we're not more insistent on results, albeit incremental and reasonable results, it's not going to be deja vu all over again. It's going to be a bad scene all over again, and we really need to redouble our efforts. The responsibility of reforming the criminal justice system of Haiti rests with Haitians and their elected officials. They must demonstrate, in my view, the political will to reform before we embark on another massive assistance program. I can't predict right now whether there is the requisite political will in Haiti to reform, but there are some hopeful signs. As I mentioned, in preparation for this presentation, I called an old friend in Haiti, somebody I'd worked with when I was there. I called Minister D'Orléans, who, as many of you know, is the Minister of Justice and a member of the transition team for the interim government of Haiti. And I understand the other members of the transition team are the Foreign Affairs Minister, Finance Minister, Interior Minister, maybe a few others. Although he's going to be leaving when the new government takes over, I thought it was very important to kind of just touch bases with him and kind of see what he thinks about, you know, the problems are. And he confirmed what we all know and what we've been talking about here for the last hour or so, that the justice system, the institutions of justice, are completely broken. They are broken, he said, because successive governments, Haitian governments, have failed to invest in the justice sector. But for international assistance, he said, we would be doing justice under a tree in this country. And he quickly added, those trees that we haven't cut down yet. Mm-hmm. The courts of first instance, he reminded me, in Haiti, were built by the Canadians and basically furnished by USAID. The point he wanted to make to me is that the government of Haiti needs to invest more of its own resources in the justice sector. Whether they're going to be able to do that anytime soon is a big question mark in my mind. By the way, of the 14 courts that were built by the Canadians, 9 of them were destroyed during the period leading up to President Aristide's resignation. But the encouraging news that Minister d'Orléans gave to me are as follows. He says that the independence of the judiciary from the executive branch, from his ministry, must continue to be a priority. In that regard, a decree has been published in the official Haitian Gazette establishing a Conseil supérieur du pouvoir judiciaire. It's a superior council that will have oversight and administrative responsibility over the entire judiciary. The council will have 9 members, 3 from the Supreme Court, including the President and Vice President of the Supreme Court, and representatives from the remainder of the judicial corps. That's very encouraging news, I think. It's long overdue. Currently, when a judge wants to go on vacation, he's got to go to the Minister of Justice and beg for permission to go on vacation. That is no longer acceptable, and I hope with this decree that will be corrected. Because of the transfer of authority that is expected, by the way, he says that he thinks that the investiture of this new council will occur sometime during the first couple of weeks of April. So we'll see. Because of the transfer of authority from the Ministry of Justice to this council, there will be a need to restructure the Ministry of Justice. Again, he made several remarks that I found to be promising. There needs to be a stable cadre of professionals working on specific substantive issues at the Ministry of Justice. Currently, specific crime problems and issues are handled by the minister's cabinet. The cabinet is made up of former law partners and other associates from the private sector who are retained by the ministry to help the minister during his tenure. When the minister leaves, the cabinet is disbanded. Many of the files that people were working on also disappear, because it goes with the cabinet. So as a result, there is really no continuity of efforts and no institutional memory in the Ministry of Justice. So you are in this perpetual state of starting all over again every time you change ministers. Well, there's a plan to fix that. There's a decree that will create several bureaus or sections within the Ministry of Justice. One to deal with judicial policy. Another is basically a small trial group to provide support, both advisory as well as litigation support to prosecutors across the country in complicated cases. And they will beef up their public defender service and the other sections in the ministry. To me, the decree was prepared in December. I understand that it's before the cabinet of ministers, that's an encouraging sign. Law reform. There has not been any real changes in the laws in Haiti. During the interim government's tenure, they've made some minor modifications, but the Criminal Procedure Code, for example, still dates back to 1835, with very little changes. That needs to change. Salaries of the judiciary, they've improved since I was working in Haiti, but it's still too low. That's a problem. The magistrate school that we invested so much money and effort to build and construct and stand up for them is non-functional right now. It's being occupied by the former military folks. I guess that's where they put them up. And that needs to change. The magistrate school really should be front and center in this reform process, and I hope that the new government will take that to heart. A lot of good work. I'm concluding. A lot of good work was done in Haiti in years past, and some good work is still being done. For example, I understand the National Center for State Courts is doing a lot of work on case management. Particularly at the justice of the peace level. other donors like the French have done some minimal, and I emphasize minimal, training of the Haitian judiciary. There's a lot of work to be done, but we must insist on several things. There must be demonstrable political will on the part of the government of Haiti to reform the system. Assistance to Haiti must be comprehensive and well-coordinated, and I think Mr. Croker pointed that out in his remarks about the police reform effort. Resources, financial resources, should be allocated proportionally among the pillars of the justice sector. Law reform is tough work. We're not making widgets. It's really very complicated. And these thoughts are just a few thoughts that I have on how we can move forward from here. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Carl. And I'd like to thank the other members of our panel for their really excellent and extremely informative presentations. We now have about 45 minutes left. We have the room until 11:30. We have an extremely large and extremely well-informed audience. And I would like to invite people to step up to the microphone and ask questions. I'd like to caution that this is an opportunity to ask questions, not to make statements, and I would ask people to be brief in their questions and to address them to specific members of the panel. And while we invite people to move to the microphone here, I'd like to ask, exercise my prerogative as the chairman here, and ask our panel members to comment on a question that's come up repeatedly when the subject of security in Haiti is raised, and that is the question of, should Haiti have an army? Should we start with the commissioner?
No. Is that a vote you're needing?
Yeah.
Could you explain a little?
I think, when you look at the police law of Haiti, it has a wide range of functions assigned to the national police, which include borders and maritime. It includes prisons. It includes things such as ports. And so in protecting the sovereign state, it was designed in the original law that there would be a transfer from this military establishment to police handling these things. And then the issue of drug trafficking and the like can be handled by police. But there again, it's an equipment item with some boats that can be provided to them and so forth. So I think really to invest now in a military establishment for Haiti would be at the expense of professionalizing and community basing the Haitian National Police.
Tim?
I'm going to look at it a slightly different way, partly from my own background in the 6 years since I retired. If you look at a national security strategy for Haiti, you need to look at the threats and vulnerabilities to Haiti and at the mechanisms that would best be stood up to address those threats and vulnerabilities. In that context, I cannot see any point for a national army in Haiti. I would argue Haiti should go the Costa Rican way, as Costa Rica, as you all know, does not have a standing army. That you need a Haitian National Police. The most you would need is an element of the police that has a responsibility for border security, let's put it in under that rubric, rather than an Air Force. Air Force would be useful mainly to patrol, to keep the drug planes from landing their 850 kilos per Cessna on some of the national roads.
Carl?
I agree with everything that's been said.
Thank you very much. Okay. Could we ask our questioners to state their name and identify their institution?
Thank you very much. Mike Jagy from the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I want to thank the panelists for a very clear-eyed assessment of the situation. And it kind of comes to two points. There's a profound incapacity, but also the politicization of the instruments of justice, the police and the criminal justice system. And both of those need to be addressed. And as Ambassador Carney pointed out, probably the most, if you will, the center of gravity, but the most dangerous condition is in Cité Soleil, which is not only a criminal problem, but it has political linkages. So my question is, how do we go about addressing that? If the formula is to try to endow the Haitian police and the Haitian judicial system with sufficient capacity and then expect them to summon the will to take on the task of addressing this political criminal structure in Sidi Saleh, is that a winning formula? So really, what is the role of the international community in all of this? Mr. Croker mentioned the fact that there's a need to support local institutions. And what kind of partnership can be created, both in the police and also in the criminal justice system? There have been other places in the Balkans in particular where the international community has recognized years later that we need to bring international judges and prosecutors to work side by side with our local counterparts. But, you know, what kind of formula can we come up with that will allow us to work together, both the international community and the local institutions, in order to address that serious challenge that they're confronting while we're trying to build their capacity?
Thank you.
Now, very quickly, because other questions are here, and I just had handed to me something that I've been pressing my office to deliver to me in time. It is the data on kidnappings for Haiti. And the chart begins in August of 2005. And then you can see that there's a spike. This is in December. And then it goes down. And then the recent numbers are actually less than in August of 2005. This is one little good sign. It's a good sign. What this tells me, Mike, is that we have a golden hour here to accomplish what we need to do. The new president, the post-election euphoria, the peaceful sort of control now that's starting to settle in. Now to do exactly what Ambassador Carney was talking about, that the Chileans had done. Is it Chileans or Brazilians that did that work in Citim? Belair.
Brazilians.
It was Brazilian. But to link those exactly with what you said, with the national police, Haiti National Police, the foreign police units, the other elements that might be viewed as bristly, but also at the same time get the humanitarian elements involved, the water, the food, the necessities of life, those NGOs who are ready to offer the hand of help to that small community, to work it out in an orchestrated way. So it isn't going in there guns blazing, but it's a careful approach to taking opportunity in this somewhat golden hour to stabilize that area, to have a good, strong presence, community policing, wall-to-wall, visible, uniformed kind of people, and at the same time, a lot of relief efforts going on. I think now, after a few weeks, months, this will come to pass. And in fact, as the latest that I've heard, this is exactly the plan that's on the table.
Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Reverend Daniel Ulysse, U-L-Y-S-S-E, with the Caribbean American Federation of Chaplain. I'd like to thank you, gentlemen, those of you who are involved in helping Haiti, especially in the police area, the police commissioner. I think a lot of things needs to be done, especially the involvement of Haitian American law enforcement professional in the United States beside Mr. Alexander. And we have Haitian American professional here, and I wonder how and to whom we should make a specific recommendation as far as our involvement, our support, because usually coming from American, European, other people, there must be Haitian element in it, professional. We have a bunch of Haitian American police officers, Navy, Air Force, their structures. There are efforts being made in that regard that have been overlooked. And I understand there's a need to continue to work together to build that relationship. Again, I thank you for the effort, but I think in our regard, in the church community, we need to get our input in this because they are social issue, humanitarian, and the church are, look at our President Bush, spent a lot of money on faith-based initiative, and these are things that have been ignored in Haiti, all the guns, all the army will not help. You can pour billions of dollars, but we need to get involved. We have our ideas how we can support. Thank you again, and we're looking forward to find ways to help you achieve your goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Carl?
Sir, I think you will be pleased to know that over the years when we were actively engaged in reforming the reform effort in Haiti, that a lot of the attorneys who participated in that effort were, first of all, Haitian Americans from the United States, professionals, successful professionals. And when we got there, we realized fairly quickly we also needed to engage Haitian jurists in Haiti to assist in that effort. And we had what I often call a small army of vetted, and when I say vetted, people that we knew were highly competent, who were recommended by respectable individuals to work on the program. I agree with you that there are contributions that the Haitian community, both living in the United States and elsewhere, can make to the effort, and we should tap into that resource.
In 1997, or thereabouts, there was an effort made by the Justice Department with support from state to place Haitian American police officers in Haiti, and perhaps 150 Haitian officers altogether were sent to Haiti, primarily from the New York Police Department and police departments in Florida. And they made a significant contribution. One of the problems with the United States assistance programs to Haiti, of course, in the late 1990s, is that they were brought to a conclusion. And so there is a precedent, and it's a useful thing to think about as we go forward. Can we have a next question?
Hi. I want to address this question to Mr. Perito.
Can we have your name, please?
Yes, my name is Shirley Pate.
Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you.
I'd like to address my question to Mr. Perito and also Senator Wallop. I'd like to understand a little bit more about the architecture of the Haiti Working Group. As I understand it, today is the second meeting of the Haiti Working Group. And what I am concerned about is that I do not see a variety of participants participating in your panel. And by that, I mean by Haitians who I believe have a much better understanding of what is going on day to day in Haiti on the ground, and that could be very helpful to your process. So if you would please share with us what it is the goal of your working group, and generally how does it operate, and what sorts of opportunities are you going to be providing for others to give you input? Thank you.
Okay, well, let me start out to answer that, and I can ask Senator Wallop if he'll join me on this. The Haiti Working Group is made up of people in the Institute, but also people from outside the Institute that are concerned with Haiti. We've had two public events so far. This is only the second one. Both of them have sought to bring together a distinguished panel of experts to talk about a problem that is critical to the future of Haiti. The first panel discussion dealt with the elections, which had just occurred at that point, and this one dealt with security. We'll have other public programs in coming months, and we hope to bring together the best speakers that we can on these subjects. And I take your point about the importance of including Haitians on these panels. Outside of these public presentations, the Haiti Working Group is engaged in a number of activities, and we've met privately with Haitian Americans in the United States, academic experts, and others. Next week, we're entertaining a group of Haitians who are in the United States under the auspices of the Department of State, and we'll be meeting with them for an afternoon. And so the working group will have a number of activities. This is a new effort for us. It's an effort in which we're sort of learning as we go. And so, we take your suggestions, and they're helpful, and we're, grateful that you're here this morning. Do you want to say something, Senator?
Yeah, Ambassador Matthews and I have been trying to identify certain Haitians who might come up here and be participants in panels that this group organizes to discuss certain rather specific operations that might lead to the structural formation of the new government and the new kinds of security issues that the panel has brought in front of us. If you listen to it all, it seems vaguely frustrating and almost impossible thing to start, because everything's starting from the beginning. If it's deja vu all over again, it's exactly that. I mean, it's another operation trying to do the same thing, only this time better. And we have in mind find certain Haitians whose ideas and views might actually expand the capacity of these panels to make recommendations when we come to that.
We have this question.
Yes, my name is Willie Thompson. I'm a member of the Haiti Action Committee in the Bay Area in California, and also I'm a freelance journalist writing for the Internet and also the San Francisco Bayview newspaper. I'd like to endorse strongly these suggestions, not only the suggestion, but the feelings expressed by people that there must be some greater representation of Haitians, I think, on these kinds of analyses of the judicial system and issues in Haiti. It will increase the credibility to our readers, to our members, et cetera, if you were to do that. Because although this morning it seemed to me that your analysis of the situation in Haiti in some cases was very good in terms of pointing out the dysfunctionalism of the dysfunctionality of the situation there. My question, however, has to do with the time frame for this deterioration and also the progress, if any, made under the previous government. It seemed to me that chart dealing with kidnapping, which might be a very minor measure of improvements or changes in the judicial system, it seemed to me that a lot of those things occurred. I mean, the graph seemed to be flat during the previous government, that is, the Aristide government. It seemed to rise under the La Tortue government. And I just wonder what is the record of that Tortue government in this situation you're now describing, the judicial system?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good question. You want to take that on?
If you look at security across governments, and I'll put the Haitian situation in a broader context, if I might, the greatest elements of order are almost always under totalitarian governments that basically, once you begin to ease the controls, look at the Soviet Union / Russia as an example in this. Once you begin to ease the strictures of totalitarian control, you unleash a lot of genies. A lot of them come out of the bottle. The kidnapping phenomena, all Haitians told me, is something very new to Haiti. Unlike the rest of the hemisphere, where Mexico City, I mean, people have insurance against kidnapping in places like Mexico City and others. It was very rare in Haiti to have seen kidnapping much before, I think it was last year, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, that aspect is a new phenomenon. Now, where it comes from, why, I mean, it wasn't, as I say, just to make money. Although, if you look at the number of people of no means kidnapped to have their families ransom them, usually the same day or the next day at the latest, for no money to speak of, $200, $300, $400, $500, maybe $1,000, which in Haiti, I might remind, is actually quite a lot of money. If you look at the per capita national income, you're struck at this element as a combination of criminal enterprise and perhaps a political dimension to it as well. Certainly you had corrupt police involved, but by and large you had individuals coming out of Cité Soleil to kidnap people, take them back into safe haven in Cité Soleil. That was one case where there were, I think, a couple of dozen of kidnapped victims in this one particular structure in Cité Soleil, with everybody in the neighborhood cheering on the kidnappers because it meant more money flowing in. And if you didn't have a job, which so many don't, and anywhere in Haiti, much less in Cité Soleil, people were happy. Your observation is correct. I'm not sure what conclusions to draw from it. Let me just leave it there, and someone else might want to pick up on that.
You want to do that? Okay. We'll take the next question. Thank you.
James Morrell with the Haiti Democracy Project. Another question for Ambassador Carney. You alluded to the UN mission and the Brazilians, their apparent slowness in deployment. I think you said it took a year to get busy in Bel Air and Cidade Militar, and they never did secure, of course, the Tessalay. How do you explain the phenomenon of their apparent lack of energy? Were there some good reasons for it that we need to understand? And under the new president, do you think that the UN mission can be more energized?
I have the great advantage of being among the few people in the room who has ever been in a UN mission. I actually had to resign from the Foreign Service with right of reemployment to join the UN mission in Cambodia, known as UNTAC, the UN Transitional Authority in Cambodia, and that was in 1992. I ran a division that ultimately had its own radio station, its own TV studio, but not transmitter, and its own print operation. That mission was so slow getting started. The force, and we're just to address the angst about the lack of a force in Haiti, the force took far longer than anyone ever imagined to get in place, with political repercussions. One of the Cambodian parties was arguing that the UN wasn't doing its job under the quadripartite accords that established the mission. It wasn't, let's see, if I recall, the Security Council resolution that established the UN Stability Mission was passed in about April of 2004. And it wasn't until December of 2004 that 7,500 people that make up the military component of the UN force actually arrived. And the mission was apparently initially regarded as Chapter 7 light. And in fact, there were some harsher things said, mainly about the Brazilians, that I won't repeat, because as the Brazilians acquired the expertise on the ground, as the special representative of the Secretary General began to grasp the Haitian equation, it became clear that there was scope for actions that would bring the force and the NGOs who provided the money to give employment in areas like Bel Air scope to operate. And that happened. Jim has been perhaps reticent to say that he and I were in Haiti in my previous capacity with his organization in February of last year. And at that point, it was dubious whether the UN was doing much more than playing soccer rather than really get engaged, with the signal exceptions of the Chileans in Cap-Haïtien, where they grasped the security nettle immediately, arresting some gang members carrying guns, releasing them, but informing the leaders that anyone who carried a gun on the streets of Cap-Haïtien would be similarly treated, only they wouldn't get out next time. The Argentinians in Gonaïves were exceedingly active, except, of course, the port of Gonaïves is to this day under the control of gangs. So, basically, there is a certain inertia, and that is the sense of physics that needs to be overcome as a UN mission gets established. Anyone who did former Yugoslavia can tell you horror stories about how long it took. Oh, sorry, your last question. Yes, I believe that the discussions that are going on now about the best combination of elements, including, let me quickly add, force, to bring Cité Soleil back under the authority of the government, those discussions are are active as we sit here.
Do you want
to? Just quickly, when we were down there with the the Institute's original mission. We were struck, excuse my voice, we were struck by the domestic political ambitions of certain of those in charge of the UN mission. And I don't mean domestic Haitian, but domestic Argentinian, domestic Brazilian, who didn't want to risk having any casualties and therefore didn't want to involve themselves in the mission with which they were charged. And it was very frustrating to watch that whole process in place without, with a mission but without any ambition to perform it. And nobody around to determine whether the mission that they'd been assigned was being performed, so there was no accountability noted by anybody with regard to those theoretically in charge. It was very frustrating for us to watch.
Mark, do you want to comment? Okay. We'll take the next question. Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Rod Vital. I was born in Haiti. I worked in Haiti as a journalist, and on your attendee list, it says that I represent Georgetown University. Indeed, I work with Georgetown University, but I come here as a weekly columnist for the Haitian Times. And my question has to do with the reinstatement of the Haitian National Army, the former army that was disbanded. When considering that three political candidates we had recently, Himmler Weibley, Danny Toussaint, and Guy Philippe, ran for president, so they were former military men. About 6,000 to 7,000 Haitian were in the army. Why you don't think that it would be efficient and beneficial to the Haitian population that they reinstate the army, when also considering that each army man in the Haitian culture almost is responsible for 2 to 3 families? That's the question I have. Thank you.
Okay. Somebody want to take a shot at that?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think joblessness, the plight of families, the human needs that are very deep in an entire society can and should be addressed. But I really don't think that to create an army in order to address that is the right answer. I think, jobs can be had by developing the economy in a proper way when governance moves, when security is proper, when the institutions are operating properly, and business returns, even, may I say, tourism comes back to Haiti. When those things start happening in a good way, then those jobs can open up. But to create more military presence and the view of a garrisoned country in order to help families to have their human needs met, I think is taking us in the wrong direction. Just a personal opinion. However, I think when you think of the need for a rigorous and substantial police of the future, there will be recruitment for the police, and the plans that are on the table call for an expanded police, and yes, engaged in some of those functions that once were held by military. And so that police, I think, in the future, with proper, background checking and vetting and so forth, can have jobs for those who had once been in the Force Armée d'Haïti. But I think that's the proper way, my own personal opinion. Ultimately, it's a decision of the sovereign state whether it would have an army or not. But I just give you my opinion.
Well, if I may add to that, Prime Minister Lafont was asked before if he would reinstate the army. He said this would be the job for the elected president of Haiti.
Right.
And with that, and the UN soon to leave, the UN forces soon to leave Haiti, somewhat, and 7,000 or 6,000 current national police officers cannot monitor the entire country.
Now this is an argument that was had in 1994, 1995, and 1996 within the U.S. government and with people, and it will be an argument that will be played out over the coming months. There's no easy answer to this question. There are good arguments on both sides.
And most people around the world would say you shouldn't have soldiers monitoring the interior. The soldiers protect the borders, the sovereign state from attack and so forth. But to take care of the safety of its people in the inside, that should be security services, police, gendarmerie. anomaly, if maybe that would be a substitute, given the Napoleonic heritage of the judicial system, for example. Perhaps a anomaly.
Anyway, an issue that's going to be talked about for a long period of time and not decided here this morning. Next question, please.
My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the Institute, and a Haiti working group occurs under my supervision.
My boss.
Senator, I think there is some risk that the panel has headed in the direction of recommending more and better. And I'm not getting a clear picture of priorities. And so I wanted to ask if each of the panelists would think of two things that they think are most important in the current situation. Is it law reform? Is it a physical repression in Cité Soleil? Is it what are the two things, fairly specific things, that are most important right now?
Thank you. Good question. Carl, you want to start?
Wow. I'd like to think that in the 12 years that I've been doing this, that I've grown a little bit wiser. Looking at my work and the work of my colleagues in my office around the world, if you want to prevent human rights abuses, you really have to focus on the criminal procedure of the country, because in that body of laws is reflected the societal values. And so from my perspective, that is probably the one of the top things that the government needs to focus on. Second, I think if we have to focus on another area in order to avoid this constant politicization of the institutions, we have to really focus on the independence of the judiciary from the executive branch. The work has already begun. The international community needs to devote resources to strengthen that independence. And then lastly, I mean, it's a current theme here about security. I think given the source of the problem, whether it's because of the economy or gangs or whatever, you have to deal with the pacification issue of gangs in Cité Soleil and elsewhere around the country as well. So you asked for two, I gave you three.
Okay. You have a bonus.
I'll try to limit myself to two, but I'm going to cheat a little bit because I'm going to establish a context within which I'm going to give those two. And the context is the continuation of the UN mission of MINUSTAH. MINUSTAH's mandate ends the 14th of August of this year, if I'm not mistaken. There needs to be a serious review and a much longer extension of the MINUSTAH mandate to provide the shield behind which my two recommendations can take place. One is a tripling in the size of the HNP to 15,000. I think that will provide the employment on the one hand, and yet at the same time provide the community policing that is so vital to see Haitians believe that they have security. And the second is centered on just exactly Carl's recommendation about enhancing the competence and quality of performance and quality of life of the magistrature, the judiciary.
Well, I might surprise you as a police officer to say this, given my domain being police, but I totally agree with Carl. I think the number one issue for Haiti today is an independent, competent, functioning judiciary. Once the law is applied and those who fall under it are processed appropriately, once the community has access to justice, And at the same time, of course, in the context of everything that I've talked about in police, then you can actually see the prison start to be empty out with the same observation about that 80-90% who are there for no judicially acceptable reason. This is a gross human rights violations that are going on right now. So if you have a functioning judiciary that goes according to the law, even if it's an old criminal law, some law, and maybe law reform, yes, but the law and judiciary that supports it, and of course my context is police, but I believe that the other thing that really would help Haiti almost more than anything else is a functioning road system. And the reason I say that is because as transportation occurs, this density of focus and humanitarian Port-au-Prince can open up. The community can stretch itself out. The governance can have reach. Police, in fact, can move. Security elements can move. The road system is so badly damaged right now that the institutions depend so heavily on it that to do that in a multi-billion-dollar renovation of the highways of Haiti, I think would do an amazing thing to help this country.
Next question.
My name is Adrian Verheul. I'm an independent consultant, but I just got back from Haiti, where I headed up a mission for the UN to prepare a program of support to Haitian institutions, notably the parliament, rule of law, electoral, and local governance. And we are about to wrap up our work. A lot of things that have been said here are true in a lot of ways. There's a tremendous need for legislative support, material support, and human capacity building that needs to be addressed. I have three quick questions, if I may. Number one, Ambassador Carney, with whom I had the pleasure to work in Cambodia, mentioned that it is in the interest of the criminal gangs to maintain a level of chaos and anarchy. Cannot the same also be said for the economic elite in the country, which has done very well for itself in the absence of a regulatory framework? Number two, I've seen the police development plan, and it's very ambitious. It lists investments in human capacity and in materiel, but leaves then recurrent costs to be paid from the Haitian budget. There's a tremendous risk here that if you do not make these plans fiscally sustainable, that you build a good police force, leave it with an economy that not can sustain it. How does the panel see the integration of fiscal realities into development of a police? Thirdly, Haiti is not a peacekeeping challenge. It's a peace-building challenge. A peace-building implies the combined approach of political, economic, social, as well as rule of law instruments. And this presupposes a fairly high amount of cohesion within the international community. What mistakes has the international community made in the past that it aims to avoid in the future with regard to a cohesive approach? Thank you.
Please, can I start? Yes.
Quickly on the sustainability of police. I have with me a plan that is being worked on now with the Haitian people and also with the and government, and certainly will be on the table of President Prevost soon and so forth. It calls for a growth plan. But may I propose that a growth plan for the police, and even envisioning instead of the current 5,000 an organization of 15,000, this has two fundamental driving requirements. One is that you have quality in this organization, and number two, that it can be paid. And as you rely on the international community to pay the payroll, there has to be a day of reckoning where that will someday end, and you can drive a sustained police organization over a cliff when the international community says, okay, that's all the money we have now, you're on your own. And so to have these two intersecting lines, you know, of local payroll sustaining power, and then the decreasing line of the international commitment to it, and meet somewhere out there years out, I think that's the best way to go, where you can then see the local capacities and the revenues that are built to sustain the police, actually can keep that police going. At the same time, the capital needs, for example, police stations and and the fleet and all those things can be built in. But to just imagine a police organization of this much that paid for it by the international community, as you well know, is can be very, very difficult because it runs out of steam very quickly, given the payrolls involved, even when the salaries aren't that high.
Just a thought on the first question. For very, very much of Haiti's history, economic elites have indeed benefited from chaos. They've generally tried to buy politicians in order to acquire what in one of my posts was known as facility, which is to say, you know, customs exemptions through bribery and what have you. One of the great changes in Haiti between the period I was there as ambassador, 1998 and 99, and coming, going back to Haiti as chargé d'affaires in late 2005, was the switch in the role of the elite. The very serious focus in the elite in support, if not actual creation, of the group of 184 plus, for example. And I think one of the telling aspects of that recognition of the economic elite of their absolute responsibility to become good citizens seen in the candidacy of Charles Henry Baker, who's a well-known businessman, who actually garnered quite a few votes, you know, of, among the presidential candidates in a race where nobody got more than 12% except René Préval. Just another look. As we look at both questions B and question C, physically sustainable and what mistakes, the bottom line is always that it's Haiti, and it is up to Haitians to make the decisions, to decide what of our advice to take, and to ultimately create the structures that make things sustainable and that that can profit from the from the monies that we make available to assist the country.
Okay, I'm going to ask, intervene here. We have just a few minutes left. I'd like to have our last two questioners ask their questions. We'll give our panel a final word, and then we'll close for this morning. So, please.
Good morning. I'm Eugenia Charles, Executive Director of Fondation MAPU. My first question is to Mr. Alexander. As one who have worked with the justice system and police trainings in Haiti, can you, in so many words, tell me how much money you thought was spent in paying expert and consultant and providing training for the police and the court system and there, how much money actually went into the trainings of Haitians to become better professionals in handling the judicial system and the police? And also, if you can talk a little bit about the a large number of Haitians that were recruited as part of the training process to become CIA agent, and what will be action will be taken to prevent that from happening again. And to Mr. Perito, can you tell me the ultimate goals of this working group and how would it be helping Haitians in Haiti?
Unfortunately, I can't answer it. Either of your questions.
The goal of this working group, as the goal of all working groups at the U.S. Institute of Peace, is first to provide a focus for discussion, for the exchange of information, and for persons concerned with a problem to come together and engage in dialogue. That's our primary mission here. We have other things that we'll be doing, and as the work of this group proceeds over the coming months, I think these will become self-evident. But in our initial series of activities, we're going to be primarily informational. There's very little programming that's been done in Washington, D.C. on Haiti. There is no other group that I know of that is similar to this one, where on a regular basis, issues related to Haiti are addressed by experts from various disciplines and from various institutions. And so the initial need we felt was to provide a forum where people would come who were interested in Haiti and listen to informed views and engage in dialogue. As we go forward, I think other activities will suggest themselves, and we'll be engaged in publications, we'll probably engage in and some training activities. We may do some travel to Haiti. There are other things that will come, but right now we're in just a beginning mode, and you have to sort of bear with us and hopefully work with us and give us your good ideas as we go forward.
I'm Bob McGuire. I'm at Trinity University out in Northeast D.C. I thank you for this panel and the panelists' comments. They were very refreshing and revealing. I have a couple of quick questions. One is a succession of Haitian governments, both elected and installed, have complained about the negative impact of criminal deportees from the U.S. and Canada into Haiti. And I'm wondering if there's any new thinking on that coming from perhaps Ambassador Carney's office in terms of a highly destabilizing element that we seem to generate. Second question, maybe Mark Croker can address this one. Under the interim Interior Minister Abraham's period, I believe several hundred former members of the FOD were integrated quite brusquely into the Haitian National Police. I'm wondering what's the state of play on those individuals. And for Carl, 20 years ago, Haitians were telling me when I went around after Jean-Claude left that they wanted demacoutization. And I've thought about that a lot, and I think what it kind of boils down to is an end to impunity within the society. And there's various manifestations of impunity in the society. It comes from the armed gangs. It comes from those who gouge prices in the white-collar type crime realm and so on. But I'm just wondering, from your perspective, Carl, what do you think might be some initial strong steps to try to start putting an end to this issue of impunity in Haiti?
Okay. Thanks very much, and we'll have one last series of answers, and then we'll close for this morning.
You want to start?
Sure. On the issue of how to end immediate steps that could be taken, we have been successful in a lot of other countries, even civil law countries, in helping them establish special investigative units, task forces made up of investigators, prosecutors, investigating judges to look at particular targeted problems of criminality. And these folks provide the space needed for the rest of the justice sector to kind of catch up. But it's absolutely critical that in the establishment of these vetted units that you are careful to have people who are highly competent, that they are paid well, and that the danger there, though, is that very often all the resources go to that group, and then that makes less resources available to the remainder of the justice sector. So perhaps that is something that can be considered in the context of Haiti to look at the gang problem in the near future.
On the matter of criminal deportees, I make, I think, just 2 points. One, there isn't a prayer that anyone I know in Congress will ask for that program of deportation to end. Right, let's start with the political reality in the United States. So what do we do? I spoke a few times with the present Minister of the Interior, Paul Magloire, and the Minister of Justice, Henri d'Orléans, about a program that might establish a halfway house, if you will, into which these deportees would be put for rehabilitation, vocational training, and that sort of thing. I can't hold out hope for anything more than that kind of a program, which might, in fact, I'm sorry, I just don't recall all the details, but I believe it is eligible for funding from the U.S.
Mark, you want to close your remarks?
Yeah, just a word on this question of the FOD inductees and that number and what has become of them, I think was your question. And I think you're quite right in asking what has become of them, because I'm not quite sure, and I don't think anyone is, whether all of those were properly vetted. And this is there's a database being prepared even as we speak on the current serving members, their training, their background, and so forth. And then a whole certification procedure is going to come out of it in the next year that should bring that question to closure. So, and with that, Bob, as I turn it over to you, thank you once again for having me up here. And I can't resist one appeal to everyone that the United Nations, which I represent in my current point of my career as a police officer, needs the support of people around the world. It is an imperfect organization, but it's only as good as the support that it gets from its member states. And I don't pretend that it is doing everything right, but I would say that there are a lot of good people who are trying to do the right thing, and they need the support. And so with that, I thank you for the invitation.
Mr. Chairman?
I just think that it's obvious that there's one answer to everybody's questions that appeared this morning, and that is that there's no magic bullet that is going to take place either by the recommendations of this commission or anything else. It's going to take patience and time. And I think fundamentally the idea is sooner or later put it in play that Haiti can develop its economy. And it can't get develop an economy without the stability that Commissioner Coker mentioned and others have mentioned. You can't have the stability without the three elements of security, the courts, the police, and the law. And you can't begin to be able to afford to sustain a law and order society without an economy that's growing underneath it. And so, and the economy can't grow underneath it without the security of the police and others. So there's no magic answer except the realization that this is going to take more than a few days.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Wallop, for being with us this morning. I would like to thank our distinguished panel, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming. And we hope to see you in about a month from today.